thank everybody for tuning in today. And the topic of suicide prevention in our schools is critically important. And I imagine that I'm probably not the only person on our call today that had their life affected by suicide. I was 25 when my dad died by suicide. To be honest, he was a Marine that never recovered from fighting in World War II. I'm not really here to talk about him, but I believe strongly in prevention. But if you lost a student, you lost a relative, you lost a friend, I think I have a pretty good idea of what you've gone through. And I didn't immediately become interested in suicide prevention after my dad's death. In fact, it was 7 years later. I was made the director of psych services for a huge school district in Texas. And sadly, that fall, several students died by suicide. The superintendent called me into his office and he said, "Scott, what are you going to do about this?" And I said, "I mean, I don't really know." And he said, "Well, you better figure it out." And by the way, that was 37 years ago, and I'm still trying to figure it out, as we all need to keep up with the latest trends, with the incidence of suicide across the ages, and especially for our K-12 age students. And I'll also never forget the very first classroom that I went into the day after the high school student suicide. It didn't take the teacher long to produce two poems that the young lady had written just before she died by suicide. And by the way, as a survivor of suicide, and when I use that term, what it really means is somebody who lost a loved one to suicide. But survivors of suicide much prefer the term died by suicide. And I try never to put the word committed with our topic today. You tell me my dad committed something, I might say, you commit a crime, you commit a burglary. Use the term died by. It seems to imply they traveled a very long road. Even a 13-year-old kid traveled a very long road. In all honesty, it was everyone's fault, yet it was no one's fault. But the high school teacher produced two poems. One of them I know by heart. It was entitled A Small Flower. Come and touch me, hold me. Use me for a gift to someone, for an arrangement in the den, for anything. Please don't toss me out while my leaves are fresh. If they do turn brown and crinkle, remember what I was before I faded away. Now, that's not the most explicit suicidal poem you've ever heard, but it certainly had heartache and non-existence. And 37 years later, that teacher still wishes she'd have just sat down with her after she read her poem and asked, "Are these your thoughts?" You're not the first person to feel this way. There is help available. I will be there for you every single step of the way. By the way, her second poem was entitled, "Dear Sir or Father, don't blame me for not knowing you. I have the picture of you holding me once. It was the last time, and why?" When I read of yet another youth suicide, I always think of it pretty simply. Adverse childhood experiences. And what are those, by the way? All those things we don't want a kid to experience. Being rejected by a family member. Being physically, emotionally, sexually abused. Living with a mentally ill or a substance abusing family member. Lots of losses in their lives. And being the victim of bullying, living in poverty, those are all adverse childhood experiences. And they're often in combination with untreated or undertreated mental illness. And I believe strongly that Florida schools have some excellent mental health professionals, school psychologists, school counselors, social workers. And often when I use the word counselor, I'm talking about any one of those three important professionals. And it's just so critical that school mental health professionals provide leadership in their school district about suicide prevention, intervention, and postvention. So I'm happy to be on the webinar today. My university, NOVA, really wants to share any and all resources we have with the state of Florida. Anybody who emails me, I promise you, I will respond and help you in any way that I possibly can. Now let's take a look at, this is like the participation part, which is the correct order for the leading cause of death for U.S. teenagers. Which one of those is it? It's actually C. Accidents are number one. Car accidents, bicycle accidents, drowning accidents, all lumped together, are number one. I'm really sorry to tell you that suicide is the second leading cause of death nationally for everybody between the ages of 10 and 34. And the most dramatic rise in suicide rates has been for two groups, middle school age girls and middle aged men. Now, here's a question for you. Who is the most protected group against suicide in the United States by race and gender? Think about that a moment, and certainly I'm going to argue suicide crosses all racial, socioeconomic boundaries in our society. But there is a group that has a very low suicide rate by race and gender. So what about the kids under 10? Do they ever die by suicide? I'm sorry to tell you that they do. In my Texas district, I remember responding to the suicide of a kid who was 9 years old. And his dad said to me, I thought I had hidden all the ropes because he tried to hang himself last week. Now, I'm not going to make the dad feel any worse than he already feels, but obviously, I'm wishing dad had called for mental health support. Dad had taken his kid to an emergency room. Dad had taken his kid immediately to the family physician. That dad would have done something. So why is it so rare under the age of 10? The literature says it's these factors. A lot more involved with parents. A lot less substance abuse. A lot less gun access. And they're not in the advanced formal operational stage, according to Piaget, where they're quite so capable of feeling alienated, isolated, and lonely. But a very big problem at the middle school level, the high school level. Now, take a look at this slide for a moment. And I really just have a simple question for you. Are these concerns appropriate for 2019? And by the way, statistics are always going to be a year or two behind. Is the media part of the problem? Are we having suicide contagion in clusters? Are schools the logical place to intervene? Are kids under a lot of academic pressure today? Are guns too available? I imagine most of you would think, yes, these are concerns in today's world. Well, the conference that identified these problems was actually held in Vienna, Austria, in the year 1910, and Sigmund Freud led the session. What's the point of me talking about this? We've not progressed a lot around the world to prevent youth suicide. And the most promising things, two critical developments. One is universal screening, programs like Signs of Suicide, and mandated legislation requiring suicide prevention in schools, and more about those two things later. So I interviewed the author of this new book about guns and suicide. And I don't want to belabor this point. I made it on a phone interview with the reporter a few minutes ago. I made it at a conference where I spoke yesterday. The bottom line is, you attempt suicide with a gun, you rarely get a second chance. You do not survive. Guns are involved in 50% of the suicide deaths in America. yet they're only used in 5% of suicide attempts. And by the way, I'm not here this afternoon to question any adult right to own a gun. I'm simply going to say with that right comes a responsibility to safeguard that gun from a troubled, depressed, impulsive, substance abusing, mentally ill person that might reside in your very own home. So what does that mean for Florida school mental health professionals? We have to have a very direct conversation with parents about gun access when they are being notified about their child being at risk for suicide. And I've had a few school personnel in Florida tell me that, oh, they don't believe they can even bring that up. And I'm like, you must bring it up, because perhaps the single greatest prevention strategy to save a life is to reduce the ready access to a lethal means. We have to bring it up as tactfully as possible. And in the interview with Dr. Anestis, he said, well, the parents are going to say the gun is to keep everybody safe. Well, sir, have you ever thought about a time when that gun might actually make your family more unsafe? And you hope dad gets it. You're being told your daughter is suicidal. So now your family is unsafe because the gun in your home is not securely locked up. And there's a website at Harvard. It's called Means Matter. They summarize the research from all around the world. You raise the barrier on the bridge, you remove the gun, and the suicide rates go down. And I'd like to share one example with you. My rich brother has his third home right here in Florida. Not long ago, he calls up. He's very upset. Scott, my neighbor Bob was seen in the parking lot 2 days ago holding a gun to his head. Well, Steve, did somebody rush Bob to the emergency room? No, they didn't. Steve, do you know, does Bob's guns, are they still accessible? Yes, they are. I actually asked his wife about that. She said I couldn't possibly remove Bob's guns. And then my brother said, Scott, what difference would it make? Wouldn't he just find another way? Well, Steve, all the research around the world says, no, they don't just find another way. And then Steve talked a little bit more about his neighbor, and I learned that Bob has Parkinson's disease. Well, Steve, let me make a guess here. Bob's physician is treating him for his Parkinson's, but not the accompanying depression. And I'm really proud of my brother. He actually went to the doctor with Bob. Bob told the doctor about his suicidal behavior. Bob is getting treatment for his depression, and Bob's guns have been removed. And by the way, you know what my greatest hope would be here in Florida? The next generation of adults, if we actually taught them how to help yourself, how to help your suicidal friend, we might have the next generation that would be comfortable taking the kind of steps that my brother did to help save the life of his friend Bob. By the way, does everybody know if I were to pull out my iPhone right now, push the button, and I tell Siri, I want to kill myself? Does everybody know how Siri responds? She says, may I connect you with the National Crisis Helpline? That is available on all of our smartphones. Kids don't have to remember 1-800-273-TALK. They don't have to remember to text 741-741 to the crisis text line. All they have to do is push the button and tell Siri. Help is available with the push of a button. So, Golden Gate Bridge, one of the two or three places in the world where the most suicides occur. And finally, after 50 years of debate, The barrier is under construction, and it will save lives when it's in place by 2021. Now, a very important development, and there's been a lot of really exciting developments about mental health focus, about more funding for mental health professionals in the schools, and tragically, it took Stoneman Douglas for a lot of this to occur, but our legislature is now much more aware of how important mental health professionals are in the schools and how we need to increase school counselors, social workers, and school psychologists. But most recently, legislation, Senate Bill 7030, requires all schools to have threat assessment teams in place to assess threats of violence towards others and threats of violence towards self. Now, to be honest with you, historically, these have been different processes. And something that I cannot overstate, the vast majority of depressed and suicidal students have no thoughts about harming anyone else but themselves. That's very important. Now, we do know that our mass murderers in this country were usually suicidal. And mass murderers basically fall into murder-suicide has four key categories. According to Dr. Joyner, who's right here at Florida State, those categories are revenge, glory, mercy. So if we go specifically to school shooters, they're usually after glory or revenge and or both. And unfortunately, our media gives them glory. But what about, I just said mercy. Doesn't really apply to school shooters, but it does apply when we have it in our families. It's usually the dad. They've decided they don't want to live anymore. Their life involves unendurable pain, constriction, and tunnel vision. But they actually, in a twisted, perverted way, have convinced themselves life for my loved ones would be pure hell without me here. So I will show them mercy and kill them first. So unfortunately, that does happen in our families. The fourth category, according to Joyner, duty really doesn't fit our Western society as much. It's more of an Eastern thinking. I could never leave the duty to care for my elderly father to someone else. I've decided I'm going to kill myself, but I can't discharge that duty to other people. So because of the fact that these mass shooters in our country, the majority were suicidal, we have sort of taken these two concepts and lumped them together. And again, my greatest concern is we don't want any discipline for students that are depressed and suicidal. We want caring, parent notification, referral, follow-up services, and checking in and helping them at school. So when might we ask a suicidal student about harming others? Because the bottom line, and we're going to be talking about the instruments wisely recommended by the Florida Department of Education and the Florida Office of School Safety, they're recommending the Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale. They're recommending the safety five-step triage. Well, when we look at those don't have questions about homicide. That's because, thankfully, the vast majority of suicidal individuals are not thinking about harming anyone but themselves. It's much more common to ask a person believed to be homicidal if they're thinking of suicide. But we need to be alert for whether or not a student is blaming others. Perhaps they've been the victim of bullying. They're clearly angry at other people. And if they are, then we would be following the excellent procedures outlined by Dr. Dewey Cornell and his comprehensive model of school threat assessment. But again, we cannot, as mental health professionals, overemphasize to our administrators. The majority of suicidal students have no thought of harming anyone but themselves. So now, if I was tuning in today, I would basically want somebody to be talking about what works. These are the things that come from the World Health Organization. I think I pretty well covered the importance of reducing lethal means. By the way, when I presented in Taiwan a year ago, kids in Taiwan, they don't use a gun. They don't have access to guns. They use pesticides. So in Taiwan, they have to lock up the pesticides. So the message here for Americans is pretty straight. And the importance of interrupting and eliminating and reducing those adverse childhood experiences that I talked about in the introduction. And education about the warning signs, especially for physicians. The literature says something like this. 70% of the individuals who died by suicide, regardless of their age, actually went to see the family physician shortly before they ended their life. I know my father did. He saw his doctor 1 week before he shot himself. So getting physicians involved. And we actually had a national recommendation that came out 10 years ago saying every teenager who sees the family doctor for any reason should fill out a short questionnaire about energy level, joy of life, depression, and suicide, and it should be scored before they walk out of the office. My greatest hope is the next generation of physicians will be more confident and more competent in asking direct questions about suicide. NOVA has a medical school, and during Suicide Prevention Week, which, by the way, is always the second week of September, on a Friday night, 7 o'clock, we had standing room only with our medical students. So I'm hopeful that the next generation of medical students will be much more comfortable asking patients about suicidal thoughts. Now let's talk about the World Health Organization's protective factors. And think about your own children. Think about all the students in your school districts around the state that you care so much about. Obviously, we wish every kid lived in a stable family. I'm really proud to tell you that I received the Helping Parkland Heal Award from the City of Parkland, and I've done countless parenting sessions in Parkland. And something that I've said over and over that I truly believe, a kid who lives in a stable family, a kid who is shown unconditional love every day, every way by his or her parents, they can overcome almost anything. But I think we know, unfortunately, lots of kids aren't shown that unconditional love and their families are not stable. They often feel in the middle every day with separation and divorces. And then obviously want kids to have good relationship with their peers, but I got a simple question. Who does a disturbed kid turn to for help? I'm going to argue they often turn to another disturbed kid. In fact, here's a question I wish we could ask every kid in Florida schools tomorrow. Who is your go-to adult at school? Who would you go to if something was really serious? And not too long ago in Rapid City, South Dakota, a middle school principal said, "I surveyed my students last week. I was really dismayed. 27% said they had no go-to adult." That presence of a go-to caring adult is so preventative and so important for wellness and connectedness. The rest of these are pretty straightforward, except I want to give you an example. Our son Jeremy was 8. "Jeremy, I need to talk to you more about the death of your grandfather. I mean, I know what happened to him. I'm sorry I never met the man, but you already told me he had a heart attack." "Yes, that's true, son, he did. But there's a little more to the story. 2 weeks after his heart attack, your grandfather actually shot himself. The word is suicide. Now that you're 8, maybe you can understand what this word means. And I want you to hear this from me, never from someone else. You lied to me." "No, I didn't really lie. Just waiting to give you more complete information." He thinks a little while, and then he looks up and says, "Oh, Dad, you shouldn't feel bad." "Oh, why is that?" "Well, your parents, they weren't both psychologists like mine are. They couldn't have possibly taught you everything I know about the importance of feeling good about yourself. I mean, everybody has problems, Dad. You just have to know, go get help." Well, wasn't that sweet that he was trying to alleviate my guilt? What's the most important point there? He's 8 years old. He believes he's a good person. Isn't that what you want for every kid in the state? I wish I could give everybody magic dust to sprinkle it over every kid's head tomorrow. And I also sincerely hope every kid walking into a Florida school tomorrow morning sincerely believes some adult at school cared whether they showed up or not. And religion, whether it's the temple, whether it's the church, whether it's the mosque, an incredibly preventative thing. And obviously, I'm always going to argue for a lot more mental health professionals in our schools because they can make a difference. All right, so moving on again. Tips for parents. And in my career, parents come up to me and they say something like this. "How do I know she's depressed? I mean, come on. Teenagers, they withdraw, they're moody. I think she's preparing me. She's going away to Florida State next fall." Mom and Dad, let me ask you a couple of questions. Is this pervasive? Is this affecting home, school, peers, pretty much everything? Yes. Is it persistent? Has it gone on for 2 or 3 weeks or more? Yes, it has. Has she dropped out of what was previously a pleasurable activity? Yes, she has. You know, I couldn't believe it. She was on the dance team for years. This year she said, "I don't care about dance." You've got a depressed teenager. Approximately 20% of teens suffer from depression at some point during those tumultuous years. Sadly, the majority never receive any treatment whatsoever. We want parents to get help for their children. We want them to share information with school mental health professionals. To be honest, critical information is often hidden from school mental health professionals. We don't know what's happening. You ever had a parent say, "Oh, she had mono. That's why she got hospitalized." Meanwhile, her classmates are saying, "She tried to kill herself last weekend." We need parents to be honest with us. We need private practitioners in hospitals to see the need to communicate with school personnel, everybody working together. Imagine you're in advanced placement everything, and you just missed 5 days of school because you were suicidal. If your AP teachers have no idea why you weren't here, they may not be particularly patient with you making up all that work. And if you don't mind, I'd like to share with you something I learned throughout my now nearly 40 years of working and consulting with schools. Don't title a parent presentation suicide prevention because they are not going to come. So what have I learned to title the presentation? Raising children in a challenging world. Are they going to get some suicide prevention? Yes. Are they going to get key points about involvement in their kids' lives? Take charge of technology. It is a privilege, not a right. Make sure you know your kids' friends and the kids' friends' parents. Make sure your kid gets enough sleep. All of those things will be a part of that presentation, as well as key principles like reach out. Don't preach to your kid. Find the shared time when your kid will truly talk to you and mostly be there to listen. So I'd like to give a positive plus to the Pembroke Pines Charter Schools here locally. They delivered an audience of over 2,200 to hear my presentation on raising children in a challenging world. How did they do that? Well, they got a waiting list for their charter school. And if your kid's accepted, you have to do continuing education. And they got credit for coming to the session. They can still get credit by watching it on YouTube. Do I wish every public school in the state had a little bit of leverage to make sure that parents come to mental health presentations? Absolutely. But the key message really for everybody is don't be afraid to talk about suicide to a kid. Let me give you a parent example. Their daughter was hospitalized a couple of months ago. She's been getting some treatment. Things appear better. What's probably the last thing in the world mom and dad ever want to bring up with their kid? That would be suicidal thoughts. But in reality, they should bring it up. Bring it up gently, in a listening mode. Have you ever had those thoughts again? Wouldn't be unusual to have those thoughts. What about the safety plan? Anything you want to add to that safety plan? You can come to me anytime. We'll get you back to your therapist. You still remember pushing the button and telling Siri, because it's not uncommon to have suicidal thoughts again. All right. Center for Disease Control, they really put so much emphasis on connections and community ability to work on suicide prevention. And at the simplest level, you know what I wish? Every county in the state had a youth suicide prevention task force with important key school personnel on it, but also county personnel linking with state and county initiatives, linking with the Florida Office of Suicide Prevention and Sophia Castro, and her email will be on one of the slides at the end of this presentation. So, what states have the biggest problem with suicide? Because it's not Florida. You probably know. There's a big clue right here. Montana's number one right now. It's always Montana, Wyoming, and Alaska. But you've got to be wondering why. Why did those Western states always lead the country in suicide rates? Why are the lowest rates all District of Columbia, New York, New Jersey, New Hampshire? Well, the Western states have a high percentage of Native Americans. They're very rural. They have a shortage of mental health professionals. There's a lot of stigma in those Western states about seeking mental health treatment. There are a lot of guns available in the Western states. In fact, the research says really clearly, stricter gun laws, those states have lower suicide rates. Western states also have the possibility of seasonal affective disorder. And then the other issue is the elevation theory, that when people live in an elevation above 5,000 or 6,000 feet above sea level, not a problem in Florida, they may not be getting enough oxygen. Their antidepressants may not work as well. So more and more upper elementary kids, fourth and fifth grade, are talking suicide. I get this question all the time from an elementary counselor. What am I supposed to do? Do I need to take this seriously every single time? Absolutely, you do. I know it's got to be frustrating. Bottom line is, I wish they could learn to just tell you, I'm angry about X. They shouldn't have to say, I'm going to kill myself to get our attention. But when they make those statements, take it seriously every single time. Notify the parents every time. But there is one exception to parent notification. That would be if we suspect abuse. If we do, now we're calling the Department of Children and Families and we are making that call immediately. So everybody always asks, what are the programs to prevent suicide at the elementary level? Okay, there's some promising data from the good behavior game. But if you're familiar with it, it's not about depression and suicide. It's much more general about wellness and respect and kindness and appropriate classroom behavior. There is a promising program out of the state of Washington called Riding the Wave. It's a fifth grade program, and yes, it does use direct language about depression and suicide. So something that we can investigate here in Florida. So bullying and suicide. There are a lot of legal cases over this issue, and I've been involved in a number of them. I was involved in this case on the side of the Blue Springs, Missouri School District. I'll be honest, I do not think they did anything wrong. They did not ignore the bullying. They supported Brandon. They provided consequences for the bullies. They notified his parents of concerns about depression and suicide. So the day Brandon died, he wrote a suicide note. He actually drew a picture of himself hanging. The note said, if somebody doesn't stop me, I will hang myself at 4:35 today. And he handed the note to a fifth grade classmate. Have you ever anticipated a 10-year-old kid being in that position? Have we prepared them in discussions at church, in Sunday school, in fifth grade, or around the kitchen table? Unfortunately not. His classmate had no idea what to do. She basically did nothing. Sadly, Brandon went home and he died by suicide that day. By the way, against my wishes, the Blue Springs, Missouri School District settled out of court for $500,000. Subsequently, the district hired me to represent them on two future cases. Why did they get sued two more times? Basically because the word went out, sue them, and they'll just settle with you. And I don't think they did anything wrong in the subsequent cases either. But I believe that when schools make mistakes, were best to admit it, settle. But if we didn't make a mistake, then we need to see these cases through to the end. Okay, got a question for you. This was actually the district where I used to work, suburb of Houston. He was new to the large middle school. His mom enrolled him, told the counselor he was severely bullied in his previous school. I'm worried about that here. Mom reported the counselor told her not to worry. We don't have any of those bullies here. Anybody want to come out and say there's no bullies in their school? Then the mom went on to say he has a couple of psychiatric diagnoses. Now, here is how everybody described Asher Brown. Really small for his age, frail, pale, had a bad skin rash on his face, walked funny, spoke with a lisp, identified as being gay and Buddhist. What do you think life's going to be like for him in a large suburban middle school? What class would be the most difficult for Asher? I think you're all thinking, clearly it would be PE. You know what his PE teacher said? Didn't even know who Asher was until after that boy killed himself. Now, there was a lawsuit, and the parents ultimately ran out of steam, and some of the bullying prevention legislation in Texas is named in memory of Asher Brown. But the bottom line is that kid should have stood out the moment he walked into that school as the kid we needed to safeguard against bullying. Now, I imagine that most of you are familiar with the Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance Survey. I'm going to argue it's the best snapshot of high school at-risk behavior we have. They're surveyed on many important dimensions. Bullying at school, bullying electronically, fights at school, scared to come to school, have they brought a weapon to school, do they wear their seatbelt, do they drink, do they use drugs, do they use tobacco, do they wear their seatbelt? All of that is there. So I'm only going to zero in on our best data at the high school level. And looking out my window right now, I can basically almost see Nova Public High School. For the sake of simple math, let's say there's only 2,000 kids that went to school there today. So what's this bottom figure mean? Our best estimate, 152 of them made a suicide attempt in the last 12 months. Who's the most likely to make an attempt tomorrow? That would be the kid with the previous history. But you know what's really scary? I'm going to argue, for the most part, the adults in the lives of those 152 kids, they have absolutely no idea. Their teachers don't know. The school counselor doesn't know. Their parents don't know. Now, who knows all about their suicidal behavior? That would be their peers. The kids that nobody ever talked to about how to help yourself, how to help your friend. I've had kids say to me point blank, what good would it do to get involved and stop Jim from killing himself today? It's his fate. It's his destiny. You know what Voltaire wrote in the year 1764? And I'm only slightly changing his words. The young man in the fit of melancholy who died by suicide today might have wanted to live had he merely waited a week. What's the job of a good friend, of a teacher, of a parent? Help somebody get through a difficult afternoon, a difficult couple of days, get them to professional help. Make sure they know suicide prevention resources. Now, when we survey middle schoolers, the data is actually more alarming than it is for high schoolers. And the bottom line, 13 Reasons Why, which was insanely popular with adolescents, had so many dangerous messages. First of all, suicide is never about revenge. Suicide is not about other people. It's about ending unendurable pain. Suicide, thankfully, is not a natural consequence or a logical outcome to being bullied, raped, or the victim of sexting. What's the good news? Thankfully, the vast majority of kids that endure those and other adverse childhood experiences do not attempt or die by suicide. Having now seen the first two seasons, you know what actually bothers me the most? No adults in the first two seasons were ever portrayed as being involved in kids' life in a meaningful way. There's not a single incident where kids go to adults for help except one. Season one, Hannah Baker goes to see Counselor Porter. And his response was such a bad example of school counselors. I don't know why they didn't picket Netflix national headquarters in California. The adults were all portrayed as absent, clueless, or even downright mean. And if you saw season two, two boys, Clay and Tony, are going to stop the school shooting. And they never even think about telling an adult, law enforcement. And we're very lucky right here to have Fortify Florida apps. And hopefully all of our students are aware of Fortify Florida. But one last point. So on the day Hannah Baker died, and obviously her graphic suicide scene never should have been shown, but 2 years later, they finally pulled it from season one. But on the last day of her life, Hannah Baker has all these revenge tapes. She's at the post office. She's going to mail them. A guy comes up to her and says, "Hannah, we missed you at the poetry recital last Tuesday. You're very talented. I hope to see you this week." You know, in the real world, that's all it takes. It had been much more realistic to show Hannah Baker dropping the tapes in the trash and going on with her life. So I think we've talked enough about connectedness in our homes, our schools, our communities. But there are a number of myths that really hold back suicide prevention. And in particular, I am hopeful that those of you listening in today have a conversation with your building principal. Forward them a copy of the slides. Make them aware that these two webinars, part one, which we're doing today, and part two, which is already archived, are available to them. So I just believe in telling the truth. And I want to give you an example, and I have many of these, but last spring, I went to a large suburb of Houston, Texas, a district with more than 40,000 students. And they set it up very carefully because my presentation on suicide prevention was really for school administrators and assistant principals. So they said, you'll do the morning and afternoon. The afternoon will repeat the morning. We know principals can't all be out of the school at the same time on a school day. So therefore, they will figure out a plan. Some of them will cover the morning, and et cetera. You understand how this works. So anybody care to guess how many assistant principals are principals in a district of over 40,000 students came to hear my presentation on suicide prevention? The answer would be one. She looked around the room and it's like, where are the other administrators? The school mental health professionals came. And if we're really going to get comprehensive suicide prevention in Florida schools, we must get a buy-in from superintendents and principals. And I'm on record and I'll repeat this statement. Suicide prevention cannot be site-based. When it is site-based, too many principals opt out. It needs to come from the school board and the superintendent. And a big shout out to Alachua County Schools. I got to talk to every school board member and every school administrator there about a year ago. Now, pretty much these points go without saying, and that somebody doesn't wake up one day and suddenly they're suicidal. For the most part, they've traveled a very long road. But something happened today. It's called a precipitating event. It caused them to follow through on their earlier thought out suicidal thoughts. What's the most common precipitating event for an adolescent? It's a severe argument with their parents. It's the breakup of a romance. It's a severe discipline situation. It's a humiliation. It's a significant loss. And although I would acknowledge suicide does tend to run in families, it's not inherited. If it runs in families, it's because they don't tell the truth. You ever had a kid say to you, I finally figured out what happened to my favorite aunt 5 years ago. Why didn't they just tell me that she died by suicide? And overwhelmingly, we have to get across to all concerned. Bringing up suicide does not cause kids to think about it. Think you could find me a high school kid in the state of Florida that doesn't know somebody who at least talked about suicide? Pretty much they would all know somebody who made an attempt. And sadly, many would know somebody who actually died by suicide. Talking about it gives them a chance to unburden themselves, to realize, I am not alone. There is help available. Somebody will be there for me every single step of the way. So here's a call I got from Katy, Texas recently. A student died by suicide. We need your help with postvention. We know bullying was not involved. Well, I can understand why they want to immediately rule out bullying, because that's what all the lawsuits are about. But bullying could have been involved. In fact, the literature says there's a strong association between bullying and suicide. But it's not a causal relationship. What's the one thing I hope you take out of this discussion today? You know a kid's involved in bullying. They're the victim. They're the perpetrator. There's also what's called the victim perpetrator. They're the victim in some situations, the perpetrator in others. When you know a kid's involved in bullying in any of those three ways, don't hesitate to ask them about hopelessness, giving up, and thoughts about suicide. Now, I've been following all of this really closely. With some confidence, I can say this. Not a single bullying suicide lawsuit has found a school district to be liable in civil court. I was involved in Lance versus Louisville ISD in Texas. It went all the way to the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court. They said the school district had no special relationship or duty because 9-year-old Montana Lance was not incarcerated, not involuntarily committed, and was not in foster care. A case against Floyd County in Kentucky went all the way to the Kentucky Supreme Court, but the district was not found liable. But I already gave you one example in the Blue Springs case where they settled out of court. So what do we really need to recognize here? Strong association, yes. And obviously, everything we can do to reduce and eliminate bullying in our schools is critically important. So what's the relationship between suicide and self-injury? So I've been interested in suicide prevention for nearly 4 decades. Why did I get interested in self-injury? Because I want to know what might cause kids engaging in self-injury, i.e. cutting and burning, how might they become suicidal? What percentage might ultimately attempt suicide? What things should we look for? And the bottom line is, I believe in stealing from the very best, and I encourage you to check out the Cornell Self-Injury Center. Many of the cases I know really well. How did the self-injury cutting behavior actually come to light? When the kid attempted suicide. Self-injury is a coping mechanism. It releases endorphins. It regulates emotions, but it has diminishing returns. It's not working as well as it did 6 months ago. So what do I want you to look out for? Have they used multiple methods to self-injure? Have they self-injured over a considerable period of time? Do they experience little pain when they self-injure? And do they disassociate when they self-injure? And don't hesitate to ask a kid involved in cutting and burning about whether or not they have thoughts of attempting suicide. And I made a video for the state of Florida with two young women who actually received a national award for their willingness to talk about their struggle with self-injury. That video is available at the website for the NSU Suicide and Violence Prevention Office, and I encourage you to watch it. So instead of an old guy like me talking about cutting that I never engaged in, I'm asking them all the logical questions. Now, back more directly to suicide. A previous Surgeon General, 47,000 suicides a year in America. By the way, most people would say it's a staggering figure, but in reality, it's probably an underestimate. We got to talk about it more. Our homes, our schools, and in our churches. Barriers to suicide prevention in the schools. In all honesty, what I'm doing today, I've done more than 1,000 times every state and about 20 foreign countries. These are the things that are holding us back. Lack of awareness of the problem, especially on the part of key decision makers like principals and superintendents. Lack of training. This is not a required training for school administrators. It's not part of their certification process. Schools not wanting to accept what I would call a shared responsibility and to develop those task forces and work with city and county prevention initiatives. I know schools are asked to do a lot of things. And I want to give you a really positive example from the state of Missouri. The state of Missouri decided that all schools were going to have suicide prevention plans and training in place. But they gave the schools in Missouri an actual year to get all of that ready and in place. And unfortunately, many people just don't want to talk about this. So, one more example. I was in Montana a couple of weeks ago, and I did a presentation for one of the school districts in Montana. And in the morning, I did threat assessment of violence. I had every single school administrator. In the evening, twice, I did suicide assessment. Anybody care to guess how many of the administrators chose to come to one of the two evening presentations on suicide assessment? The answer would be not a single one. High school principal walked in and said, "Oh, is the technology working? Okay, good." And he walked out before I made even an opening statement. So you need to, as mental health professionals, partner with your principals, talk to them about the scope of this problem, and work together. You've got to be a leader in this particular area, and I know that you can do that. Okay, so what do I believe? Suicide prevention in the schools. What's the goal that we need to work towards here in Florida and really everywhere? I believe in annual training on the warning signs of suicide for everyone. Everybody from the bus driver to the cafeteria workers to the superintendents to the secretaries, everybody know what to look for, what to do. Don't keep a secret. Here are the referral procedures for our school. And then post information on the district website about suicide prevention. And I have provided that information in a resource I will get to in a few moments. Occasionally, I will pick a Florida County school district, go to the website, and I will put in youth suicide prevention, teenage depression, and I'll see what comes up. To be honest, not much. It should come up immediately. The second leading cause of death for every student 10 years and older. So what should come up? National Crisis Helpline, local state resources, tell the nearest adult. Who do I contact at school? I could be searching for information for my kid, my friend, myself. And then I'm a very big believer that the important school mental health professionals, we need to role play. We need to be very competent, asking questions about suicide prevention. We need to become very familiar with the Columbia and with the safety and role play. When I have several hours with a group of school mental health professionals, I get one of them to role play being suicidal. And I say, I'll do assessment. If I screw it up, we'll talk about it. And then you're going to have a chance to break up into dyads and you practice. And parent notification procedures, they need to be in place. And I believe that notification needs to be hopefully done in person. And I'm going to ask parents to sign a notification form. And what if Mr. Smith says, I'm not signing your form? Well, I'm going to go out of my office, bring in the nearest staff member, and ask them to witness that I've notified Mr. Smith today that I believe his child is suicidal. And would you just witness that the notification has been made? And I talked about follow-up at school, which is critically important, and the need for community interventions and services. and a reentry meeting when they come back from the hospital. I already talked about important information being hidden. First morning back. Hopefully a meeting before school. School counselor, administrator, parents, and the student. Talking about their reentry and how we can support that student. And once we have all of these things in place, now we're ready to start investigating curriculum programs where we actually talk to kids in classrooms about how to help yourself or to help your friend. And by the way, in the second half of this, I'm going to go into great detail about suicide assessment. I go into detail about safety plans and how no suicide contracts have been sorely criticized because they're all about what not to do as opposed to the safety plan developed jointly where we're sitting side by side with the student. What are your ideas internally? Something has kept you alive. What have you done when you've had those suicidal thoughts? Internally, how do you calm yourself down in a crisis? Externally, who have you turned to? Who can you turn to in the future? And then I also talk extensively about postvention, which we need a plan in the aftermath of the student suicide. And I was involved in developing the first after-suicide toolkit for schools from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. That was 2011. I was involved in reviving the one that came out in 2018. And yes, Dr. Wheeler mentioned the very important model suicide prevention policy from the Trevor Foundation, from the American School Counselor Association, from the National Association of School Psychologists, and from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. So I would highly recommend you print out that document and have a meeting with your school administration about suicide prevention. So I'm really excited to tell you that Florida is really promoting suicide prevention certified schools. It's really important that Florida schools have the opportunity to become prevention certified. And we need to celebrate that when schools have become certified. Senate Bill 1418 requires a list of approved suicide prevention awareness and risk assessment instruments. And I already talked about the importance of the Columbia and the SAFE-T. And really what this is all about is school mental health professionals need to get involved, and these assessments should be administered prior to calling for the Baker Act team to come out. And I can't answer all the questions about how the mobile crisis response teams might be working in your county, how the Baker Act might be working or not working, and what the issues are. But I can strongly recommend that you get with your administration, you look at like what's worked, what's not worked, what are some of the frustrating things that have occurred. Let's troubleshoot and let's work through all this better. And there's a really important website. It's going to list the approved youth suicide awareness and prevention trainings for K-12 instructional personnel. And I want you to promise me that you will go to that website and look at that list and utilize those programs. Excellent direction has been provided to us here in Florida, and encourage your school to become suicide prevention certified. So a couple of things that FDOE and the State Office of Suicide Prevention have done. They've identified the Columbia and the Safe-T, and those are instruments that I talk a lot about in part two of this webinar. And FDOE will keep an updated list. And the legislature said no new duty or liability is created by this legislation unless there was a willful or a wanton act. Now I'd like to highlight some other resources for you. My partner is a former principal. She's now retired. But for the state of Texas schools, first we did the Texas Suicide Safer Plan for the state. Then we did the Texas Suicide Safer Toolkit for the state of Texas. And I note and I apologize that the word prevention is misspelled there, but I think you all know how to spell prevention. But most recently, we did the Crisis Action School Toolkit on Suicide for the state of Montana. It's available at multiple Montana websites. In fact, you put in Montana Cast S. Once you get past the cast of the Hannah Montana television program, you've got it. And you have my permission to use that, modify it, utilize it in any way you wish. It has 32 downloadable tools. And I noticed Dr. Wheeler actually posted it for you. And I'm just finishing the New Jersey Guide to Prevent Suicide. That's in the final stages. And then one of the NSU school psychology doctoral students, Catherine Ivey, and I are about to complete the Florida Steps Suicide Toolkit for Educators to Prevent Suicide. So hopefully we'll have that up on the website here at NSU and be talking with FDOE and the Office of Safe Schools about how to make everybody aware of that particular guide. So what would you find if you started looking through the Cast S? We designed it so that it would have tools for administrators, tools for mental health professionals. There are the tools for the administrators. More tools for administrators. Additional tools for administrators. Very importantly, the tools for counselors. When I say counselors, I'm talking social workers, school psychologists, counselors. Suicide risk report, safety plan, parent acknowledgement or notification form, the Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale, a risk monitoring tool from the book that I did with Erbacher and Singer. Came out in 2015. We're working on a revision right now. Reentry checklist, postvention checklist and steps, care for the caregiver, screening mental health providers out there in the community. So, legislation, and I don't want to spend a long time on this, but want to point out the Jason Foundation and their Module 5, Youth Suicide, a Silent Epidemic, 2-hour online face-to-face in-service training, which is free, is listed as one of the approved training programs for the state of Florida. Another Jason Foundation one, Mental Health Issues Surrounding Suicide Ideation, is also listed there. Others listed, Youth Mental Health First Aid, Signs Matter, Response High School Suicide Awareness Program, More Than Sad from the Society to Prevent Suicide, Those are all listed and very important prevention programs, as are Act on Facts, At Risk for High School Educators, At Risk for Middle School Educators. Those are all listed on the website I had up a few moments ago. I know Mr. Flatt personally. He lost his son Jason to suicide in 2007 when the state of Tennessee passed legislation requiring all teachers in the state to get annual suicide prevention legislation. Well, I obviously figured out Jason died by suicide. But then I thought, I bet his aunts like the lieutenant governor, right? No, no political connections at all. But Mr. Flatt sold his insurance empire and went to work on suicide prevention at schools. And there's a wealth of information at the Jason Foundation. I'm proud to tell you, with my colleague Rich Lieberman, we did 5 modules for the Jason Foundation. Let's see if I can remember them all. Suicide and depression, suicide and postvention, suicide and self-injury, suicide and bullying, and the one we worked on the hardest, suicide and LGBT. What is the single greatest protective factor for a gay kid in America? Be thinking about that. And I'm going to go back to a question I asked you earlier. Who is the most protected against suicide in America by gender and race? It's African American females. Why? Sisterhood. Purpose. Religion. Protective factors. So what protects gay kids? Parental acceptance. So there's the website for the Jason Foundation, and I encourage you to check out that foundation and the wealth of resources that they have for you. Best practices in schools. I've made these points, but I'm encouraging you, as a school mental health professional, be a leader. Push for at least a school task force. And once you get that in place with administrative support, then link with county and state initiatives. And I have just one more example, and I believe that I'm going to be able to finish exactly where I did when I did this the very first time. The Hope Witzel tragedy, Hillsborough County, Florida. So what's it all about? Hope was one of those early sexting cases. Apparently she finally gave in. And she sent a picture of herself topless to another middle school age boy. By the way, if you have a 12-year-old daughter, you're about to get her a laptop that has a camera in it. What do you think I'm going to say to you? Don't do it. If they have a laptop, keep it on the kitchen counter. By the way, most adolescents in this country are chronically sleep deprived because we start schools too early and all that technology interferes with their sleep. But Hope finally gave in. And what's virtually every 8th grade boy in the world going to do with that information? Of course, he sent it to everybody. So it's all over school. He's disciplined, and well, he should be. Hope is also disciplined. But Hope had to continue going to that middle school. She's taunted and harassed. It's a couple of months later. Hope has a fresh cut. Teacher calls for a school mental health professional. It's a Friday afternoon. They meet with Hope and they have her sign a no suicide contract. Remember, part 2 of this is going to talk about those must be replaced with safety plans that are all about what can you do to keep yourself safe. Unfortunately, that school mental health professional did not contact Hope's parents. I'm really sorry to tell you that over the weekend, Hope died by suicide. After the funeral, Mom finds a no suicide contract on the school stationery, signed by the school mental health professional. Do you see a defense here? Because when I was asked, I said, settle it out of court. Your staff member made a grievous error. Your challenge is to make sure that no other staff members make such a grievous error. You need to redo your training. Now, amazingly, the plaintiff's attorney failed to even demand, where's your documentation you ever trained school mental health professionals on parent notification? And the school district prevailed. The district did not settle out of court. The judge encouraged the Witzel parents to refile, but clearly years have passed and they're not going to. My biggest concern is, and let me state this in a positive manner, I believe the vast majority of the time schools do things right, but once in a while we make some pretty grievous errors, and not notifying the parents is perhaps the most grievous error that we can make. And when we make mistakes, we need to learn from these cases. Instead, we have a tendency to bury them. So I doubt that very many of you are actually familiar with the outcome of this case, which actually was right here in our state. So I very much hope that if you haven't already watched or tuned in to part two, I hope you will, because I go over very extensively more details about the relationship between bullying and suicide. I talk about the fact that we now have new consensus warning signs to use suicide. So what's really different? I mean, still we have to be concerned about giving away prized possessions, making out a will, dramatic changes in behavior, withdrawal, moody, but also we need to be concerned about overwhelming pressure that they're experiencing, about hostility and about irritability. And I talk about youth that are at risk. And by the way, think of it this way. When a suicide occurs, it's like taking a rock and throwing it into a pond. That ripple effect in the schools, the neighborhoods, and the community. And I'm going to argue the ripple effect is greater than ever before today. I think you know why. It's because of social networks. And a principal might think, okay, she played on the school soccer team. This is really tragic and sad. Her classmates, her teammates are really upset. Well, yeah. But wait a minute, she played on one of those club travel soccer teams. There were 9 other high schools that had teammates. It's affecting all of these schools. And in part two, I talk about Joyner's important model, that the desire for suicide has 2 key components, perceived burdensomeness, thwarted belongingness. But kids have to acquire the capability for suicide. This is where self-injury comes in, because they're habituating. They're getting comfortable harming their body. So lots of details, postvention examples, suicide assessment, safety planning. Those are all part, as well as responding to clusters and contagion. And one last thing before I turn it back over to David. I believe strongly suicide needs to be talked about more with students, but in a classroom group or even smaller. I do not support assemblies, and I actually got this written in page 30 on the After Suicide Toolkit for Schools. Why no assemblies? An assembly, especially after a suicide, is dramatic. It's glamorizing. And kids are not going to ask you a question in an assembly. They might ask that question in a classroom. They're always going to know, why did he do it? The answers have died with him. What method did he use? It's not important that we talk about the method. How can I help you? You lost a classmate. You lost a friend. How can we help everybody with their shock, their grief, their confusion? How can we work to prevent further suicides? A kid in a classroom once said, will I be next? I sat next to her. Well, I'm glad that he brought that up so we can talk about, yes, it's now more on people's minds. And that's why we need to make sure everybody knows what to look for and what to do. And in an assembly, kids are going to be upset. They're going to go out every exit. You're not even going to know who they are. But please know, there are people traveling this country very eager to come to an assembly about suicide. We must talk about it more, yes, but in classroom groups and smaller. Well, back to you, David. I don't know if there's any final thoughts here.